If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Well, hello, everyone. It's Monday. Yay! Best night of the week. I am Helen, RFR ambassador and your fearless psychic and co-host for this evening. And I'm joined by Rob. Hi,
hello,
Rob.
Hello there. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing, honey?
What have you done with Kara?
I sucked her into the void. So they are trapped at an airport and cannot speak.
Ooh, that's a horrible punishment you subjected her to.
I did. They, you know, blasphemed, and this is the punishment.
What did they do? What did they say? I'm curious now.
I'm sure they blasphemed somewhere. I'm not sure exactly what they said, but I'm sure that they did.
It's hard to imagine that they could have said something that would be worth the punishment of being stranded in an airport.
It was pretty severe. I'm sure they took the Lord's name in vain or something. That's why he got banished to an airport. So before we get started, I do have a disclaimer. So tonight we're going to be talking about politics. And as a reminder, Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization that does not endorse or promote any specific political party or candidates. The speaker will be presenting general information about untangling political views from religious ones and may reference some of their own political opinions. People of any political affiliation are welcome to participate in the meeting, but we ask that everyone keep comments civil. And if you disagree with someone, do so respectfully. Violators and trolls will be removed immediately. So listen, I know a lot of people get a little fired up about politics, but just be kind. Just because someone has a different view from you does not make them a bad person. Just be respectful and kind and you won't get booted. But if you start acting all like buttheads, you're going to get removed. So don't be buttheads. All right. So, Rob, do you want to go ahead and introduce our guest for tonight?
I will. It occurs to me that I do not know how to pronounce your last name, Jason.
Rashiotis.
Okay. what Jason said. So Jason was raised in a secular household, but was always interested in the relationship between politics and religion. He grew up learning about the cultural significance of religious traditions and went on to study political science at George Washington University. He's taught social sciences previously and has been volunteering for this organization since May of this year. And he also hosts the Non-Essential Workers podcast. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Want me to start the presentation?
Go ahead, Jason. Like, the floor is yours, man.
All right, perfect. Let me get this up for us. So, can everyone see this cheeky little
we got it
image? Okay, great. So
is he on the ballot? Did I miss that?
It's from 2016, don't worry about it. So thank you everyone for being here. As said before, my name is Jason Rashiotis. Been volunteering with RFR since the spring. Studied poli-sci at GW in Washington DC in our capital. I've taught, as we said there, poli-sci, economics, history, philosophy, and today we'll be talking about how to better understand politics and civic engagement after coming out of religion. I would like to start with a gigantic grain of salt. Tonight, we're going to be talking about social sciences, otherwise referred to as soft sciences. These sciences, like sociology, anthropology, economics, political science, revolve around human societies and our relationships to each other. People are flawed. We don't always behave consistently. And this is in a stark contrast to the hard sciences, biology, chemistry, physics, etc., where the mechanisms we observe are much more constant than our own decision-making and our own cognition. So just keep in mind, when I speak about rules or trends or patterns or characteristics or our political nature, I'm not speaking with scientific fact and certainty in capital T truth. This is not to say we have bad evidence for how we study ourselves. We have great evidence. We understand human civilization pretty well, but people are different and we arrive at different conclusions. And so nothing I say here tonight will be gospel. Certainly don't treat it that way. Feel free to question everything I'm saying. So, with that, I'd like to start with some quick word association. What are some of the ideas and feelings that naturally come to you when you hear the word politics? Are they positive feelings? Are they negative feelings? Are they about specific people you may know or have heard a lot about? does the word inspire change and action in your mind, or does it inspire futility and powerlessness? So here's some things that come to my mind. Things like office politics, getting passed over for a promotion, not being part of the in-group, feeling that something's politically incorrect or offensive or judgmental, or that people are thin-skinned and you can't talk to them anymore. Controversy, scandal, polarization, conflict. We don't get along. It's uncomfortable feelings. Secrecy, duplicity, unaccountability of those in charge. Maybe corruption and bribery, nepotism come to mind. The elites, the wealthy, people detached who live amazing lives while the rest of us kind of toil here. Do our leaders have our best interests at heart? So I bring all these up because, especially in America, we have some really negative associations and connotations with politics and getting things done through our political process. And I think we can see how that has played out in the last 20 years, largely, but going much farther back. So to root this and orient this and why we're here, what do religions have to say about politics? So religions, new and old, have had various conceptualizations of politics. Is it something to be ignored, to be dealt with, to be leaned into? Is it essential to the faith? Now, I'll be speaking very generally here. If we look at Judaism, if we look at the Old Testament, if we look at the Torah, there's rules about slavery and property and how marriages work and how you get compensated and how many oxen things cost and what you can wear and what God, who God favors and who he wants to lead their kingdom. So clearly, there's a very lean in. God's part of this process of figuring out state building. In Christianity, we see a slightly different tone because Christianity mostly grew and flourished under Roman rule and eventually on top of Roman rule. So we have rules about what good works look like, helping the poor, how to give charity, how to respect laws that exist already, who really has the authority. Islam, and a couple centuries later, we start to see a lot of that structure back. How do we distribute resources as a state? What is a moral way to behave? How do we institute charity? How do we make society more godly? Hinduism. I'll cover Hinduism and Buddhism here. Eastern religions are often thought of as less political somehow or apolitical, but that really could not be further from the truth. Hinduism is extremely rigid in its hierarchy and creation of the caste system. And in modern day India, where most Hindus live, their political parties are almost entirely religion-based. And I just quickly wrote in there that this was became more so the case post-British colonialism. But there's tons of evidence of ancient Indian statecraft, words like Rajadharma, duty of the king, Artha, wealth and power, Kama, pleasure and aesthetics, that were all necessary to get towards Dharma. And then with Buddhism even, Buddha spoke extensively on politics. He was not neutral. He had views on democracy, on mixed market economics, on internationalism, and he viewed the state as something that could either inhibit or help getting you towards happiness, pursuing happiness, liberating yourself from suffering. So none of these religions have nothing to say about politics.
Hello, my name is Dr. Kayla Black, and I'm a clinical psychologist, professor, author, and the director of the Secular Therapy Project. In case you aren't familiar with it, the Secular Therapy Project is a program of recovering from religion that aims to help secular, non-religious people find good mental health care. Specifically, we screen our therapists to make sure that they are appropriately licensed, use the most evidence-based types of therapy, and that they are secular and non-religious themselves. This helps ensure that science and reason are what guides your therapist, not personal religious beliefs. If you'd like to learn more, or to look for a mental health professional yourself, or if you'd like to apply to be one of our therapists, please visit us online at seculartherapy.org.
So let's talk about the scope and range here. Some religions want their followers to be politically inactive and disengaged. So this is just from the Bible. I've pulled up a lot of quotes, some of which I'll read. Romans 13:1, for example, quote, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God." So clearly, we have a direct claim here that God has legitimized all governing bodies. You have to follow them same way you'd follow God. There's a whole bunch here. We can reference them later. You can look them up for yourself. But we also have the opposite from religions, where they want you to be politically active and engaged and have call to actions as to how to get involved in this system. So just a quick from which one do I want to choose? Acts 22:44-45. Quote, and all who believe were together and had all things in common, and they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as many had need. Or here's another one. Deuteronomy 15:7-11. If among you, one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. We have a direct call to action. If you see someone poor, you see someone homeless, you have a duty, you have a religious obligation to help them, however much it'll cost you. So even within the same religion, we see very different calls to action or calls to merely follow the rules that exist. So we're getting a kind of a mixed message here from religion about how to engage in politics. So let's move now to when we deconstruct or deconvert, what else changes? Because the deconstruction process that many of you have been through when it comes to your own particular religion you came from is not limited to religion. We can examine and deconstruct any set of beliefs and any set of assumptions we have. So, especially deconstructing from religion, your views on eternity might change. What's the nature of our universe? Can something be infinite? Your views on mortality will definitely change. Is death permanent for us? Does life matter more now that I realize I only have one? Our views on economy might change. What do we do with these resources that I was previously forsaking or I thought were infinite before because I would just rely on God? How do I deal with the scarcity of a modern economy? How do we deal with helping someone who's poor, like we saw in the last Bible verse? Our views on morality. How do we act towards other people? How do we live our lives that's in a fulfilling way? How do we treat our environment? Camaraderie. Who do we spend our time with? What's our connection to other life? Are we really above the rest of animals, or are we all related and connected and have obligations to each other? Views on sexuality. How do we conceptualize sex? Who can do it and who with? And what does it mean to us? Does it mean we have to get married? Does it mean there ought to be consequences to it? Or do we get to shirk those ideas? So with this concept here, I think you might see where I'm going, that our politics can be deconstructed and examined the same way. That breaking free from religion is going to open up an entire world of questioning. And I hope to help you guys tonight question some of your views on politics and maybe how things currently work. So, if God is not the foundation of government, what is? It's a perfectly fair question. So, for much of our history, humans have attempted to create order and maintain hierarchy. It's how we've survived. It's how we've gotten through tough times. And if it's not directly God, well, what's the closest we can get to? A divine mandate. Someone as close to God as possible. A pope, a king who's got a connection to God, an emperor who convenes with God. But those have problems. And we've seen some evolution towards more royal lineages and bloodlines. So maybe they can't directly call God, but they're of a better, they're better, stronger, more capable people. We see similar with caste stratifications. That your family status and who you are at birth matters and decides who gets to be in control and who gets to do the work of society. This has evolved into things like our class divides, the haves and the have-nots. Do people with property and people with wealth, are they the ones who get to govern because of dint of their success? We see this in conceptions of who's in the norm and who's in the marginalized groups. Well, we're like the average. There's the plurality of us, so we get to be in charge when it comes to racial, gender, sexual preferences. And the much more modern conceptions that a lot of us were probably born in, hopefully, is that of a social contract and an acknowledgement of human rights. We have instances like the Magna Carta, constitutions or elections, that our conception is that we get to govern and that there's no God deciding it for us. God didn't invent democracy, but that we decide this for ourselves. You don't have to be connected to God. You don't have to have royal blood. You don't have to be part of the highest caste, that we collectively decide together how we ought to govern ourselves. Now, I do want to emphasize that these are not all mutually exclusive. You see a lot of these coupled together throughout history and maybe even in the modern day. So a quick note here on drawing out this difference even more between religion and modern conceptions of government. This is a significant major shift. If someone no longer believes in the authority of a divine creator, we should expect a lot of cascading worldview changes. This is a simple way to process one of those major shifts, especially when it comes to understanding what government and politics should mean to us. So when we look at revealed scripture or divine will from our God, this operates under the assumption that the values that this God has are unchanging. They're written in stone. They're permanent. God has always known what's right and wrong, and that they are the will of the higher power, and we simply either obey or disobey their authority. I'm defining this as what we call authoritarian. There's a direct top authority. We either follow it or not, down. This is a huge contrast to modern popular democratic operation. Modern democratic thought operates under the assumption that values are very much changeable and debatable, as they are the will of the people, but the people are a constantly changing population. So we have to constantly mutually agree to the terms of how best to follow our rules that we make for ourselves. This is what I'm going to define here as communitarian. Instead of the authority being locked in one eternal figure, we all share and agree that we have authority over each other and that we as a community do this stuff together. So now that I've gone on for a while, let me get to a definition of what politics actually is. Politics is the collective action of people, coordinating and mobilizing their efforts to accomplish something, exerting their influence, getting people to do things you want them to do, making rules for everyone in society to follow, creating institutions to enact and enforce those rules, fighting for particular interests or motivations that really you're passionate about, and figuring out the rules to governing, who can, who counts, who's a member, who's a citizen, who's a participant. And I want to give some examples here that organizations like the NRA or MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, are very much political. They have a cause, they pool resources, they find people with common ideas, they lobby, they make their efforts heard, they write legal arguments. This is politics. Finding people who agree with you, pooling your resources, mobilizing it towards some direction. Also, I have here mentioned political action committees, amicus briefs, even things like social media. The ability to leverage an audience for some purpose is politics. So let's talk about the dynamic here.
You wanted to define the term amicus brief. A lot of people might not know that.
So an amicus brief is essentially a legal opinion written to higher courts, usually to our Supreme Court. So if some law firm is writing an amicus brief about, here's how you should rule on abortion, that's doing politics. We like to think our courts are very neutral, but that's a myth. Every part of our political process is political. That should be well understood. So let's talk about the dynamic here with how does power play into this? Because politics isn't merely just getting together with people you like and figuring stuff out. There has to be some element here of how do you convince people or how do you force people to change their minds? So I've broken this down into persuasive power and coercive power. With persuasive power, we have the ability to convince people. When you deconstructed your faith, you didn't choose to now be not religious or choose that it was wrong. You were convinced. There were arguments. There were reasons. There was evidence. Stuff seemed faulty. Some stuff was built on very weak evidence, and you realized that. And so persuasive power relies on our acceptance and belief in logic and argument as an important, useful, and effective way to communicate ideas. Coercive power is a little different. Coercive power is the strength to make someone do something through force or violence. And this relies on a belief and an acceptance that hierarchy is effective, that if someone can, that might makes right. So once again, politics here is largely about how we achieve power in order to enact one or many people's ideas. It can be achieved in many ways. You can persuade people. You can convince people with good or bad reasons. You could coerce them through mechanisms. And people have justified power to themselves in many ways throughout history. Okay. Let's connect this to somewhat more of an American-centric view or a Western-centric view. There's a bunch of philosophers here I'm going to list who create a through line that has led to a lot of modern American institutions. This is an image some of you are probably familiar with, or a concept you're probably familiar with. Wherever we come from, there are philosophical roots that have helped inform and shape our lives, our culture, our history. Has anyone here ever heard the phrase, everything in moderation? This is an old Aristotelian philosophical endeavor where he thought, you know, people go overboard with some things. They have a deficit in other areas. We got to find that golden mean, that Goldilocks zone where we're not too hot, we're not too cold. This idea was very popular and was building off of the work of people like Socrates and Plato and other philosophers at the time. But it has had some strange consequences. In the modern day, you'll often see images maybe like this from the 2021 Pew Research Center's political typology test. Or here's a couple other examples of political spectrums. So, in a political context, has anyone here ever heard expressions like, oh, both sides are equally bad? The truth is somewhere in the middle. I'm not very political. You know, I vote for members of both parties, or I subscribe to horseshoe theory. So, these are some examples of extremely either inadequate or overtly deceptive ways to analyze our political spectrum. So let's break these down one at a time. What does it mean for the middle? What does the middle mean in our system? And what's the extreme of our system look like? Is the middle analogous to two people's interpretation of an event, getting two witnesses who see a car crash? Is that what there's the truth somewhere in the middle? How does that connect to politics? Or how does it connect to moderation? What is the deficit versus the excess, like in the Aristotelian example? These are flawed images because of a number of things. One, normative and subjective claims here that freedom is what lies in the middle and slavery is what lies at the poles. You should be scared of the extremes. We can only our system, our crazy system, is the one that gets us freedom. Or like in this image, only democracy is in the middle. Dictatorship and misery is on each pole. These are flawed and these are biased, and there's intentionality behind it, which we'll get to next. So just another thing I want to mention here, is our system really the only one where there's freedom? This is a total lie. America ranks very poorly in almost all measurements of freedom among modern democracies. So now we're going to look at a much more accurate and representative image of what our political spectrum can look like. So, I don't know if anyone here has seen this image before, but it's become relatively popular in the last decade or so. Instead of making normative value judgments about where freedom, slavery, and democracy appear on the spectrum, this format descriptively places people where their ideas actually fit in the wide world of political ideologies. Almost all modern American politicians fall in the top right quadrant here that we have labeled as authoritarian right. Now, this might sound scary, might sound intuitively wrong, and there are a couple problems with this image, which I'll talk about. But I just want us to keep in mind that when we think about our most extreme left-wing candidates and our most extreme right-wing candidates, they're all kind of showing up in the same place when we actually evaluate what they've done governing through comprehensive testing. We also notice something, that our mortal foes, China and Russia, seem a lot closer to us than we might have thought. We might also notice that founding fathers, who were so important to our conception of our own politics, like Washington and Jefferson, are way far away from what we think of now, and that their conception of what a government should be and should look like is radically different 250, 300 years later. And maybe that should tell us something about whether constitutions should change more or less. Another quick thing to mention here is that this dot where it says Marxism really should just say Karl Marx himself as a political philosopher, the same way that we see other political philosophers here, like Rothbard, Rand, Proudhon, Rucker, Chomsky, Mandela, Stein, Gandhi. And just a quick other mention, some interesting figures show up here. Maybe people that we have positive feelings towards, like Gandhi or Nelson Mandela. And they show up in a quadrant that not a lot of people show up in. So, if all of that was too complicated to understand or help you figure out where you fit, I strongly encourage people to take free online tests like this. I believe it's important for people to figure out what they actually believe. And once they understand what they believe, what they want society to look like. Our beliefs inform our actions and inform our choices. So we owe it to ourselves to figure out what our own goals and perspectives are with clarity. So, very simply, the single axis left-right, not adequate. We need at least two. Now, the simple way I want to sum this up is that the horizontal axis, the x-axis this way, is what do we want our society to look like? Who should it be for? Who should we be helping? And the vertical axis, the up-down authoritarian versus libertarian, is how do we accomplish that? Do we accomplish that with a big, strong government that enacts a bunch of rules? Or do we do that with a very small, limited government that enshrines a couple small things? other variables and dimensions exist, such as breaking up economic views so that they're not all so intertwined. And once again, this isn't perfect, but this is a much more accurate way to view what people actually believe in the world than simple one-axis images. Now, I've come up here with a little funny image of how Batman would behave differently if he was in either of these quadrants. So if we had Batman maximizing his American prowess, he'd perhaps become a fully deputized police officer instead of a vigilante. He'd leverage his wealth to gain more power. Maybe he'd even run for mayor of Gotham or even higher office, who knows? And if Batman were tomorrow to become a 1970s Chinese communist, he'd maybe give up his no-kill rule, hunt down the supervillains who have given him such trouble, and give the rest of his property and his money to the state so they can rebuild their society. If he's more of a modern-day libertarian left-wing socialist, you know what? He's got a lot of money. He should redistribute that towards maybe psychiatric and rehabilitative solutions instead of carceral ones. And instead of fighting supervillains, maybe he should attack the police state. Who knows? He's a smart detective. And if Batman's reading a lot of Ayn Rand, well, maybe he's just do what he's always wanted to do. Join his foes in supervillainy and become the most powerful and cutthroat of them all. Now, this is to be taken as a joke. We all know Batman doesn't exist. But
hey, and there's actually an animated series with Superman as if Kal-El spacecraft.
Yes, if he was, if he fell in. Correct, right? Exactly.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Go watch that and see how they conceptualize these differences. But I illustrate this because many people are uncomfortable with this idea of being in the extremes, no matter what quadrant it is. We all kind of feel like that's scary. That's kind of icky. That's uncomfortable. Well, what if we push a very likable figure in either of these directions? Okay, so now that I've done that, I would like to acknowledge that people have biases. That's okay. Biases are not intrinsically bad. You shouldn't feel bad for coming from a particular background and having a particular lived experience. Biases are heuristics and shortcuts people use to make and solve problems, or solve problems and make decisions easier. Biases have flaws and blind spots, of course, and we don't have full information when we prejudge things. They can misinform us. They can push us to make faulty assumptions, but they are essential to who we are. And so when we hide our biases, we actually prevent ourselves from doing politics effectively. If we're not honest with ourselves or with people around us about what we want and believe, how can we work towards the same ends? How can we know we're on the same side? How can we pool our resources to accomplish something? So I want to mention here that pretending or trying to not have a bias is a bias itself. Saying you don't have opinions is a de facto accepting of what the status quo is. This is important to remember. And at best, this is delusional. This is someone not realizing their role that they play. And at worst, this can be really manipulative. When people don't take a side in an issue, they are taking a side. They're taking a side of whoever's got the advantage in the first place, the status quo, those already in charge. So, yes. I will now show for everyone just that I wear my biases on my sleeve. I'm totally open about it. If you go listen to my podcast, you will be bombarded with it. I have a perspective. I have a slant. I have a view. I'm not ashamed of that. I'm actually proud of that. Because I was not born with these beliefs. I had to learn them. I had to look at evidence. I had to examine. I had to figure out for myself what felt right, what felt wrong, what seemed intuitively fair or unfair. Where can I study? Who can I learn more from? And so if we look at the political compass test, this is where I show up in the left libertarian quadrant, pretty far down. Once again, it's okay to show up wherever you show up. It's okay to take these tests. You don't be afraid of your beliefs. This is also another type of test called the 8 values test. It's got some problems, but it's a little harder to convey the image as well. But it shows pretty clearly where I view the intrinsic tension between equality and free markets, or the tension between nationalism and internationalism, or the tension between state authority and individual liberty, and the tension between traditional values and how we structure the family unit versus progress and liberation. So I think this should be pretty clear from what I've already conveyed that these are my beliefs, but I want people to not be afraid. I want people to feel less stigmatized about having a perspective, but also be unafraid to question their own perspective, deconstruct their own beliefs, figure out why they believe a thing, the same way that maybe you've deconstructed faith. Let me see if there's anything else I want to mention here. Yes. So the eight values test I like for a couple reasons. Most of our political realm covers these last two categories, the liberty and authority, the tradition and progress. You might notice that whether you like it or not, the financial decisions seem to just be made no matter who we vote in, or the international decisions tend to be made no matter who we vote in. That's the case. That's that intuitive feeling is onto something. And so much of American polarization is arguments about these last two quadrants, which are kind of safe to talk about and to argue about. The top two, that would threaten the system if we were to change those too much. So people are allowed, and they get all riled up about social causes and why are my traditional values? Why do I have to use pronouns? That's not the state authority. People get really riled up about those last two. And we tend to not pay a lot of attention to what we're doing with our weapons and our drones and our missiles and how we're distributing money. That all kind of runs on autopilot. So I want you to consider why that might be. Okay. Let's get to another topic that I think is a pretty important confusion that's often made in American political discussion. The difference between the concept of polarization and sorting. Two different concepts often get confused. Polarization is fundamentally about extremism. It's about us becoming more ideologically extreme or more ideologically pure. So I have here a definition: divergence of political attitudes away from the center and towards ideological extremes. However, this makes a flawed assumption that the center is somehow not ideological, that people in the center have no views, or they have contradictory views or incongruous beliefs. However, still, polarization has a lot of purchase in our media discussion about this kind of stuff, and it's associated with a lack of social trust, a lack of cohesion, neighbors not getting along, just being afraid of your neighbor, loss of confidence in our system to accomplish anything, because the idea is that people are so extreme now, they can't get along. They can't meet in the middle. This is in stark comparison to sorting. Sorting is when either political parties or citizens establish their own ideologically consistent worldview and platform. So the clearer the party's beliefs are, the easier it is for citizens to figure out whether their beliefs fit with that party or don't fit with it. Or maybe the need is that we need another party. So sorting is about precision. It's about understanding your own beliefs. It's about understanding who else shares those beliefs. So like I've talked about before, I think we have a duty to understand what our own views are and what we ought to advocate for. So the better we sort our own beliefs, the better we'll be able to do politics, the better we'll be able to pool our resources with people who agree to accomplish what our goals are. This is how collective action gets done. When people know what their own interests are and who they can work with, they can do it. When people are confused and unsure and think they're in the middle and they don't have a coherent worldview, how can they leverage that? How can they turn that into power? How can they turn that into action? So, by examining the underlying assumptions we or our preferred political party make, we can sort ourselves in a way that makes sense. And instead of being scared of extremism, like polarization wants us to feel, we need to be honest about how extreme people are feeling. People have a lot of strong feelings these days, and it's understandable. The status quo is clearly not working for us. If we look at the poll that we conducted at the beginning here, people feel that politics is important or very important to them, and that our votes really do matter. And yet they're unhappy about the political process, and they are worried about our democracy being under threat. So clearly the status quo, whatever it's been going, the elections that keep turning out candidates who didn't get the most popular votes, that's concerning for people. And so maybe instead of running away from these scary words like extremism, we should embrace them and understand, why am I feeling this way? Why am I being pushed this way? Why does this extreme position seem so coherent to me?
Shall we share the poll results, Jason? Do you want to talk about them?
Sure. Unfortunately, I think we got more participants involved. Yeah. So as I was just saying, people overwhelmingly seem to say that politics is important to them and that our voting matters a lot. We have near 90% on both of those combined. And yet most people are neutral or unhappy about how our political process is going. So all this is getting at what I'm saying here, which is that we've got a system that's been chugging along, and yet people are unhappy. They feel unserved. How do we figure that out? How do we sort ourselves in a way that makes more sense? How do we figure out what's in our own interest? How do we figure out who else agrees with us? That's the process of sorting. Okay, let's move on to another concept here, which is politicization. What does it mean for something to become political? So there's two ways we can look at this. Do we have something neutral that's been made political, or something that's political clearly that's trying to be made to look neutral? So when you see a fact or something that there's well-established credibility to, trying to be turned into an opinion where there's now multiple sides and people can have a perspective on it, creating doubt on a topic where there's already a high degree of evidence or certainty, or everyone just kind of gets it. Why are we trying to question this? That's the politicization process of trying to turn something well understood into a partisan issue. And the opposite, like I mentioned, something that's already very clearly and obviously political to us, attempting to be pushed into neutral. Taking something that has political implications that are subjective, like we talked about before, if we're in a communitarian society where we vote for things, our values are changing and we decide that together. That's what why I use the word subjective. And yet trying to treat that as something natural or outside of us, something objective. This is done to shut down and prevent discourse and avoid change, whereas the top is done to create discourse and confusion over a topic that was already well understood. But you might be asking, but wait, Jason, isn't everything already kind of political? We've gone through all these definitions of power and how we should view things. What is apolitical? What is objective? And those are great questions that I might have some answers for, but not great ones. This is the journey, the process of learning about this stuff, is figuring out what you believe is objective. How do we analyze what's apolitical? So I have a couple examples here I want to use. Let's just get right into it. Guns, gun control, gun rights, the right to bear arms. I think everyone can agree here, it's clearly political. It was so political that the founders felt it necessary to make an entire amendment devoted to it. They felt it was under the purview of politics. And yet, people today trying to say we can't change rules on guns, that these are so sacrosanct and just natural to the American way of life, they're beyond reproach, they're beyond questioning, seem to be want to be making something political, making it neutral. Another example, let's get right to it. Abortion. Is it political? Should it be political? Well, the science is well understood. We understand a lot about birth. We understand a lot about conception. The concept has existed for millennia. Nothing in our laws until this last century trying to rule on it. And yet we're trying to make this neutral thing. You know, human childbirth is difficult and with all sorts of flaws, trying to make it into a political thing. Well, isn't this really murder? How do we force that in? How do we fit this square peg into a round hole? How do we make this a thing that our laws already have rules on? This is the politicization process. And like I said, guns, abortion, these are issues which many of us have watched in real time or seen throughout our lives become more political or become politicized. Climate change, another example. Is it political? Well, there's a almost near total consensus by the scientists, by the experts in the field. There's a clear trajectory of the world getting hotter, of it causing natural disaster problems and climate issues. But there's some policy implications about energy, about our resources, about how we do geopolitics to get other people's energy, about sovereignty and independence of countries and states, and holding people account for the damage maybe they've done if you're in the oil industry. Yeah, I mean, you know, the science isn't political, but the actions are. The calls to change our actions are. Healthcare. Should healthcare be considered political? Is it not the role of a government and a society to take care of its people? Is it not the same as like paving roads and make sure people can get to and from work? Or is it a consumer choice that's up to the market and be driven by things like profit motive? These are issues that either become politicized or becoming depoliticized, and we get to engage in that and figure that out for ourselves as a society. Okay. Let's get to another important caveat, especially in American politics, that of ignorance and apathy. So, change requires questioning authority, questioning the status quo, questioning our elders and those we've been told know best. Those with power are not going to voluntarily make changes out of the goodness of their hearts. This stuff doesn't happen automatically. people have to do it. The status quo, whatever that may be, no matter where you are, relies on ignorance and apathy of the voting population. So the existing people with power can go unchallenged and unchecked. Social rules and social propriety, things like, oh, don't talk about religion and politics. Don't talk about your wages. Oh, that's uncouth. These are mechanisms that help keep us separated from one another, disorganized, keep things cloudy and unclear. And no, I'm not recommending you go to work tomorrow and ask everyone what their wage is, but the more clarity and understanding you have about how you place in this organization or how you relate to your neighbors, the more informed you'll be to figure out what you want to do. When people share and act on their beliefs, we're no longer atomized. We have the strength in numbers to rival what are previously viewed as systemic problems that are just too unwieldy and encumber us too much to do anything about. And an example of this I want to give is that over the last 90 years that we've been tracking presidential voting data, U.S. presidential turnout has never been above 63% and never been below 49%. That might sound high to some of you, might sound very low to some of you, that there's clearly a devoted block of people who are constantly showing up, and yet we are nowhere near the percentages of people who could be showing up, who could be having their voices heard. And we should ask why. Is that because they're told to not talk about religion and politics? Is that because they haven't dared question these foundational assumptions? Is it because they can't really relate to their neighbors? They don't know what they're advocating for? Okay, so equipped with all this information, what do we do? How can we get involved? How can we participate? How can we undo the damage that we're clearly seeing in our system? Primarily, we need to question our own beliefs. Figure out what we believe, why we believe it. Do we have good reasons? Are my beliefs based on evidence? Are they based on gut, visceral instincts? Once you figure out what you believe or where you're leaning or how you're feeling, find your community and build solidarity with those people. Connect with them, understand them, learn from them, be challenged by them, question them. And fundamentally, take actions locally. Start unions at your work or clubs or organizations. Join volunteer organizations like RFR. Run for local office. Go see what's going on your kid's education board. Run for something local that you've got skills in. Maybe you're good at financing or managing money. Run to see what your town's budget is like. There are no simple, easy solutions that you can just check off and be done with. This requires concerted hard work and effort over time. But it is the best way to fight off these negative emotions that we're constantly bombarded with about national resentment and fomenting anger and violence. Build connections in your local community. Now, I'm not sure if our hosts here have, but I've given a whole bunch of links. Links to how to register to vote, which is probably a little late for tomorrow, but how to register to vote, how to form a union, how to run for office in the four largest states in America, New York, Texas, California, and Florida. How to start a political action committee. These are how to call your congressperson, how to send them an angry email. This is how you get involved. It might sound cheesy or sound small, but this is what politics is. It's not mysterious. It's little small things you can do every day. People you can reach out to, people you can connect with, things you can do at work. So, time permitting, I'd have a couple other concepts I want to get to. Is everyone feeling okay with time? And
yeah, you have another like 15, 20 minutes, man, because we started around, 10 past the hour. So you're good.
All right, perfect. So now that we've got some local conceptions of what we can do, let's talk about the national stage that we are obsessed with, is our national political system. So does it all just come down to picking your guy? Well, the media kind of wants you to think that way. Our media has incentives to not go beyond the celebrity, to focus on the charismatic ones, the tall ones, the white guys. There's other incentives and reasons going on here why we have an emphasis so much on individual figures, individual representatives, individual presidential candidates. So while having figureheads is by no means a new concept, we've had kings and emperors as far back as human society goes. What is relatively new is how many people any given single figurehead is supposed to represent and advocate for. So no other time in human history did we have a president who's representing a billion people in China, or a billion people in India, or 350 million people in America. These numbers are staggering. And if we look back in the Old Testament, we look back to the size of towns and cities, thousands of people, maybe tens of thousands. And so fundamentally, our current political system is not adequately lined up with how many people there are. And I'm certainly not making an argument that we're overpopulated. I'm making an argument that our reliance on single individuals is flawed. So more so here on the media coverage, we have talking heads who, instead of trying to convince you and give you arguments, they're just shouting at you. They're just screaming at you, believe what I believe. This takes out the need to think critically. Who here is appealing to your most base guttural instincts the most? Who are you vibing with the most? Those that tend to be the people that we watch on television. The internet age adds a whole extra layer here. The rabbit holes you can go down, the algorithms, maybe some of the rabbit holes that led you to RFR when you're questioning religion. The tech companies and their roles. They're private, but they're doing kind of public forum, free speech stuff. It all gets messy. And so it's very hard to delve beyond who are the celebrity figures that are overtaking our political life. There's also an important emphasis we have to be aware of here, that psychologically, human society has been constantly looking for structure, for alpha males or representational leaders who look like us and sound like us, and we feel we can connect with them. We crave the structure. We want strong, confident, charismatic leaders. It's easier to be a follower than to be one of these leaders. We can offload our responsibility. We don't have to do the hard work of coming up with solutions and sharing ideas if we can just let the other big, strong people do it. And this flawed idea that, well, if someone looks like me and they sound like me, maybe they have the same ideas and values as me. Well, I think we'll address soon why that's a flawed concept. So, because we're kind of running low on time, I did want to give a quick spiel on a lot of isms that people seem to be very confused about and have lots of questions about. And I'm sure I haven't been checking the chat for my own safety. I'm sure these questions will come up throughout the night. So, number one, Marxism. What is it? What does it mean? Who is it? What's the deal? Why is everyone always talking about cultural Marxism? What's going on? So Karl Marx was just one guy, just one political philosopher, socialist thinker in 1850s Germany. Socialism existed way before him. There are other conceptions of socialism. And unfortunately, especially in an American context, Marx seems to have absorbed the entire world of left-wing political philosophy. And I think that's not good. So whenever you hear someone say Marxism, ask them what they mean. Do they actually know much about what Karl Marx wrote? Socialism, another big scary word. Ooh. State ownership and management of production. It's really that simple. Imagine everything's the post office. Now, hopefully you have a better experience, but you want to go get food, you go to the state store. You want to go get your license renewed, you go to the DMV. You want to go turn on your TV, you turn on the government-run satellite TV that you got. That's the concept of socialism. That instead of free market capitalism driving industry and production, that the state could do that, that that's under the state's purview. And if people believe that, people believe, no, private systems are better.
Hey, communism. Jason.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, before you go on, can you, for people that may not know the difference between Marxism and socialism, because those get sure. used interchangeably.
Yeah, I'll just clarify that again. Yeah. Socialism is a concept existed much longer before Marx. Marx is just one guy. Like it's here's an analogy. Biology existed far more than Darwin, than Charles Darwin. Biology has existed in many forms. There's many different disciplines. Even ideas about evolution existed pre-Darwin. He clarified it and he had some really good evidence and he got a lot of notoriety later in his life, but he does not subsume biology. That's, I think, a healthy way to look at Karl Marx in relation to a lot of left-wing politics.
Okay, appreciate that. Thank you very much for clarifying.
Of course. So let's look at the next big bugaboo word, communism. Communism is, once again, pretty simple. The collective population owns and manages everything. Ideally, in communism, there's no state at all. There's no hierarchy. There's no authority figures. There's people who are good at certain things and people who are good at other things. and they manage those things with each other as a big collective population. Does it seem kind of dreamy and silly? Yeah, I can admit that. But it's not some scary, oh no, we're going to murder you. That's not the idea. Fascism. Another big scary word that people are feeling a lot these days. Pretty straightforward. It's a government system, emphasis on national and or racial purity. Tends to be pretty antagonistic with the rest of the world because the contrast is our state is being attacked on all ends by everyone around us. We're better by dint of our nation. And so we need to fight those around us and conquer those around us and show them how much better we are. Pretty cut and dry definition of fascism. Let's then go to capitalism, which so many of us are just born into and assume economic system where corporations control the markets. They are free to decide what should be cheap, what should be expensive, what we should be able to buy, what our choices are. They should compete with each other. That's capitalism. And so I'm trying my best to not load any of these with any particular value so you can decide for yourself which of these makes sense. Do any of these fold and fit together? Can they live in concert with each other? Let's get to some less political ones directly. Racism. Supremacy. Supremacy of one race, inferiority of another race, often based on fixed phenotypical or neurological traits. So next time someone says, oh, you know, you think that said you that thing you said sounded kind of racist, don't feel like someone just shot you. Maybe reflect, was I making an assumption about some group? Was it something about how they look or something about how they act and behave? The same, almost identical when it comes to sexism, the supremacy of one sex over another, the inadequacy of one to another, about the fixed roles and characteristics of that sex, what they ought to do in their lives, what they are good at, what their limitations are. That's how we define sexism. Ageism, very similar. The supremacy of being young or the supremacy of being old and wise, prejudices about the ability and competency of certain groups. Oh, well, you're too young. You don't know any better. Oh, your brain's not fully developed. Oh, you're too old. You've lost your motor skills. These are prejudicial views about age. Are some of them based on some science, some reality about cognitive limitations or pre-development? Sure. But we want to be careful to not prejudge people and assume things and certainly assume supremacy over other people. This is the last one here, which I thought was kind of interesting to include because it's showing up a lot. And I felt it was probably necessary to address wokeism or being woke or all this kind of modern social justice language that people seem to be very confused about. Generally speaking, woke is a very contested phrase. Usually it's used in a derogatory context. However, it does have roots in the Black community and much farther back than you might imagine. So the concept of becoming woke goes back all the way to the 1930s of Black intellectuals realizing, there are systems of oppression layered on top of each other that are affecting us, that they intersect and they affect us in all sorts of strange ways. And so people have been getting woke for almost 90 years. You just keep that in mind when you get all stuck on, ever since 2014, everyone's been woke. Another way I want to put this is it's usually used as a rebranding of the phrase political correctness, people feeling like they're not allowed to talk about certain things anymore, that people are too thin-skinned. And yet from a positive view, the people are woke now to being offended, to being talked down to, and they're not going to take it anymore. Once again, origins in the Black community. So it's become much more popular since the 2010s. We've certainly seen in the last decade, almost all of social media is obsessed with the people fighting this for it or against it. And yet, once again, like I was saying with Marx, if someone's talking about being woke, sit them down, ask them, what do you mean by woke? What does it mean to you? Who is this about? Who does this include? How are they part of your in-group or out-group? And so tackling these words one at a time, neutrally, without jumping to conclusions and getting angry, figure out what people mean when they say these words. These are some definitions I've given. They're by no means comprehensive, but just when you're thinking about these words that give you certain feelings, take an extra second to consider why you're feeling that way. All right. I'll try and rush through these couple last slides. I think there's some really interesting data here. So let's talk a little bit more about, well, we know what local actions we can do. We know how to kind of build solidarity. We know how to figure out what our own beliefs are. What should we be understanding about our own system? What is democracy? It's a good question that not a lot of people ask. They just assume they know the answer. So I want to talk about some other layers of systems. Monarchy, governed by a single leader. Very straightforward. Gerontocracy, governed by the old, because we assume they're wise or no better. Theocracy, ruled by religion or ruled by the clergy, because they're closest to God, they know best. They know how to order a society because God does. Technocracy, not a very common one you see, but it's ruled by experts, by expertise, by people who, the people who do the decision-making are the people who know the most in an area, have the most knowledge, are the most credentials in a certain area. I've clumped these four together because they're all pretty close. Aristocracy, plutocracy, oligarchy, kleptocracy. You'll often hear these when we're talking about our political opponents. Oh, he's just an oligarch. Oh, well, we don't like that country because they're an aristocracy. So very quickly, one by one, aristocracy ruled by the high class, those with titles or the most property. Plutocracy ruled simply by the most wealthy people. Oligarchy ruled by a very small elite group. And kleptocracy ruled by leaders who use their political power to expropriate wealth and property from those they govern, people who are corrupt. I think you'll start to see that these are not all mutually exclusive, and that we have a lot of these layers no matter where we look in the world. So, democracy, what's the deal? What is it? Rule by population. The popular vote on laws, on policies, that's what democracy is. A republic, very different. Ruled by representatives, people who represent the population when they get together. But wait a second. Doesn't a republic almost sound by definition like an oligarchy? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So, like I said before, these are not all mutually exclusive. In fact, many countries have most of these in some way. So don't be afraid of these terms. Be aware that when people are throwing them around, what are they actually meaning? How different are the people they're accusing of having these traits compared to our own system? Keep these things in mind. Okay, very quickly, a couple final things about American government in particular. I just drew a contrast here that there's a big difference between democracy, where you as a citizen are directly voting for laws, for policies, for changes, versus a republic, where we're picking individuals who do that for us. We are letting them, by dint of their expertise or wealth or knowledge or power, decide these things for us. Presidents are very different from things like prime ministers. Congress is very different than things like parliament. And I will talk about the president to dictator pipeline momentarily. So once again, presidents usually have more authority and sovereignty than a prime minister, because instead of being beholden to a party like a prime minister, we elect them and choose them and they get to do what they want. They have more authority. They can control an entire military. They have control over entire budgets. They have control over entire executive agencies. Very different from a prime minister who's simply in charge of a political party and trying to hold together this government until it all falls apart. Congress is one of the earliest modern democratic institutions, and it shows its age. It heavily leans towards states' power and states' rights over the national power or just individual citizens' power because of the emphasis on senators who have the most voting power and two per state, no matter the difference in size of state. Parliaments are very different. They are created to create a coalition government. In parliaments, there's usually at least three parties, usually four, five, or six. Whereas in American Congress, there's two that only ever have success. So in a parliament where you really can't ever get a majority, you can't ever get a 51% first past the post, which we'll get to momentarily, you have to get along with people who you don't agree on. Even though you're all sorted into your little political parties with your own discrete different beliefs, you have to work together to get anything passed. And so parliaments are a little more volatile in that they fall apart easier and they call elections more frequently, but they're not at loggerheads at each other's throats all the time like our system seems to create. So like I was saying before, parliaments are much more vulnerable to falling apart. Prime ministers are just as vulnerable to being replaced by their own party. If they're doing a poor job, their party will replace them. I think we all saw this summer as Liz Truss, the new and no longer Prime Minister of England, lasted a month and a half before her party said, we don't have confidence in what you're doing. Get off the stage. That might seem weird to us, that how can it happen so quickly, and how come they seem to be run by as silly people as we do? There's problems with these systems. So let's talk about this president to dictator pipeline. Post-World War II, many countries in Africa, and post even colonialism, many countries in Africa were given governments propped up by America, by Europe, by the West. And some of them adopted democratic republics like us. Some of them adopted parliaments like most of Europe. And it's pretty easy to see that when a president has more unilateral power and has more authority and has more sovereignty, they can go rogue much more easily. And you might be saying, oh, Jason, that's ridiculous. How could a president ever go rogue? And then you remember that we live in America and we've been through the last 2-3 years. So going rogue is not some foreign concept anymore. I think we've all seen what this can look like and attempt to look like. We've seen this in recent years in Turkey. We see this all throughout history. When people who are given a little too much power, they want to take more. This is much less likely to happen under a parliamentary system where a prime minister is constantly worried about their own party, as opposed to riling up the masses and getting us towards a kind of fascist, everyone's on my side or else. Okay, very quickly, sorry, I know I'm going a little over. A couple more things here to know about voting, because voting is complicated. And even though one of the main call to actions I gave today was go register to vote, go vote. I don't care who, what party, I don't care what third party, I don't care if you write someone in, vote, participate, get involved. There's a lot more here. So we do not have mandatory voting in America. In America, we treat the default position as you don't have to vote. You don't have to be involved. You can just sit here and watch as things go how you want or don't. But in some other parts of the world, they have mandatory voting. And here I will talk about why I think mandatory voting is kind of important. So a lot of arguments come up like, well, we don't have a national holiday. How are people going to take off work? Make a national holiday. Give everyone a day off. Do it on a weekend. Let everyone participate. Count mail-in ballots. So I want to draw a contrast here, which is that the freedom to not participate should be a choice. It should be intentional, not the default position. I believe that, you know, the default position in a government that you're involved in is tell us what your opinion is. And if you really don't, it makes you really uncomfortable. You don't have to participate, not the other way around. So ranked choice voting, another popular option, another option that seems to be coming up in a couple small states. I have a personal example of this. I was visiting family last week, and we couldn't decide which restaurant to go to, so I organized a ranked choice vote between a Turkish place, a Chinese place, and an Italian place. And we each assigned point values to which one in what order. And I ranked stuff number one, other people ranked stuff number three, and whoever had the lowest score won, because it was most people had it closest to their top rank. Ranked choice voting, which we've studied for a long time, turns out much better results than first past the post. First past the post is what we're all familiar with. You get 50% plus one dude, you win. Majority is all that matters. That's what we do. That's how we do it in America. But in a lot of the rest of the world, you can't really ever get to a majority. You need a plurality. You need some kind of proportional system. And that generally speaking, people are happier in their proportional systems. People feel freer and they say they're happier and they feel that their government matters more in proportional systems compared to majority systems, where one team feels like they won and one team feels like they lost. And so I'd argue that things like first past the post and majority aligns itself much more like sports, where it's a competition instead of a coalition, where we're all getting together. We're all mutually agreeing what society should look like. Instead, we view it as it's us versus them, in group, out group, in my religion or not. So these are some other ways to look at how our voting systems work. I don't think I have time to really get into things like voter ID and gerrymandering and how we limit voting, but suffice to say, everything I've said before, the same mechanisms of those in charge, those at the status quo, affect our voting as well. And I will just wrap up with some images. This is a map of the US states voter turnout in 2020, which we had a very high turnout for that election, which I was actually pretty happy with. But we might notice some trends that the coasts seem to have a little bit higher proportion of voting. The middle and the north of the south is kind of lagging behind in who gets to show up. And that some of our biggest states like California and Texas are maybe a little lower than we thought in terms of participation. Florida, people got very involved. Very interesting. And we don't have all this data from 2020, but we have some other data from 2008, which was another very high turnout year, as we can imagine why. So here we have an image of voter turnout by race and ethnicity. And so we see that white turnout really high. Asian Hispanic turnout, not nearly as high. Turnout by sex and age. So here we divided male, female. But as we look at ages go up, turnout is higher the older we are. And that young people are really lagging behind in feeling involved in their system, feeling bought into their system, feeling that they can have a voice and change their system. And this is the Obama election where lots of young people showed up. So this is even a period where there was overrepresentation of young people, and it's still heavily lagging behind the older people. We see a similar trend here, except instead of by age, we see it by level of education. So people who don't graduate high school are being unheard almost entirely in this country. And people who have advanced degrees feel they've got the expertise to always want to be heard, and they show up more than almost anyone else. And so we can see a trend that might fit our intuitions here. Similarly, turnout by income. Is anyone surprised the more money you make, the more invested the system you might feel, and that people who control what you do with it, how your money is spent, you vote more? And people who are suffering or are poor, despite what the verses in the Bible say, feel less bought into their system and feel less taken care of and participate less. So I think all these trends illustrate a pretty coherent image of some of the issues we're struggling with in America. And hopefully this presentation gave you a better sense of how to view politics, how to conceptualize some ideas, how to define some terms, and how to reflect and question your own beliefs. That's all I've got for you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Jason. That was a lot.
Yes, it was.
It was. I'm glad. Hopefully this will be up on the podcast soon. So just a reminder, the YouTube videos take a little bit of time to go up, but if you go to Spreaker, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, subscribe to the RFRX channel, and this will come up a lot faster there than it will on the YouTube. So if there's anything you guys want to review, I strongly suggest you do that. So we have a few questions. So I'm going to start off with one, and me and Rob are going to trade off. The first one that was asked was, how does one engage and why, how does one engage with someone and why should I engage with someone that and act respectfully to political liars that admit to lying and ignoring facts? Why should I be respectful to those people? This person is asking, not me.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying, which is that if someone is clearly acting in bad faith,
correct,
how can you engage in politics with them? How can you honestly have a conversation with them? It's an excellent question. I think it's probably similar to what a lot of people have felt when they've talked to a pastor who's in bad faith, giving the same shitty arguments that they already know are silly. It's hard. It's really hard to deal with people like that who are so invested in the system as it is that they will lie, cheat, and steal to maintain it. It's hard to give advice there. My advice would be, understand your own beliefs as best you can, find people who agree, try to advocate for something that you can get behind. You're not forced to engage in this dialogue. You're not forced to engage in these arguments with people. Arguments might come up when you're trying to figure out what's real and what's not and what you believe. But if someone's acting in bad faith, you don't have to give them the time of day. You're not obligated to.
I thank you.
Okay, so the next question, I'm not so sure I even understand it, but I'll ask it anyway. This was when you had the test and the results that wind up in one of four quadrants up. Sure. And they said, can people have different positions on the four quadrants on different issues?
Yes, absolutely. So if we look at that eight values test, maybe you feel very strong when it comes to traditional values, but you really want an international kind of equality-based financial order. That's certainly capable. And it's like I talked about at some point in the middle of my conversation about what does it mean to be moderate? What does it mean to be in the middle in America? And oftentimes polls like that are flawed in that if you've got extreme views on either kind of poll, it'll kind of drag you into the middle. This is a flaw with all kind of data analysis, but it's perfectly okay to have views that seem inconsistent, but there's people who have reasons for kind of segmenting different parts of their worldview.
All right. So somebody else asks, what is the source of your definitions of socialism and capitalism? Some economists like Richard Wolff use different definitions.
Well, I didn't check any of Richard Wolff's work. I think he's an excellent teacher. I tried to use as simple and short definitions as I was comfortable with. There's certainly, as I said, much more verbose, detailed definitions of those. I want to crystallize them down to as simple a concept as possible, and as not value-laden as possible, so that we're not making a subjective judgment. Oh, I don't like that they're a capitalist. I don't like that they're a communist. I want to just simply put, these are the concepts being included there. But this is the beauty of political philosophy and political theory and political science, that we argue about these ideas. Definitions could change. They could become more precise over time. They can change over time. Hopefully that answers the question.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, definitions serve.
Right, they're not normative.
They're not normative. You can change. Yeah. They'll change and mutate. And like, you know, what I think socialism is might be different. That, I mean, like, I think we have similar ideas, but you might have a completely different nuance than I do, you know, so.
Okay. So this next one is from me. I didn't type it into the chat, but I typed it here just now. And this is a personal experience thing. The folks I talk to in Europe, and I know a lot of them, Moscow, UK, Germany, and they consider themselves progressive, but they're shocked that voter ID is an issue here at all, and that only the Republicans want it and the Dems oppose it. They think it's totally logical, fair, and reasonable because they have it there. Why is this such a political situation in the US?
It's a good point. It goes right to what I was talking about, how things become politicized. So in America, the general trend has been that people are pretty resistant to the government telling them what to do, to get a license, to have rules and how to sign up for stuff. And so people generally in America are pretty skeptical of when the government asks them to do a thing.
But by the way, I've said that and then they push back. Well, but you need whatever to go to get a driver's license.
That's what I'm getting to.
Credit card, right?
In Europe, there is a much wider acceptance that the government's role is larger, and that's okay. And that taxes are higher, and that's good. And that taxes on luxuries and commodities are higher, and that's good because that's how we pay for society. So for them, it's not a big pill to swallow, this idea of getting a license. Everyone kind of gets along. There's no problem. Whereas in America, there's much more strife that underlies this issue of who gets to vote, who's counted for how long. And so we are not that far removed from half the people here not being allowed to vote or even own property or be seen as anything other than chattel. So there's all sorts of other values that get injected and laden into arguments about voter ID. It's the same thing with all the hot button issues I hit, like climate change and gun rights and abortion, that there's all sorts of other meta arguments and part of our cultural history in particular that gets folded into these and why they become so emotionally supercharged.
Okay, thank you.
All right, would you please explain the difference between crony capitalism and just capitalism?
I will try. Okay. So people like to conceive that there's a good and a bad way to do almost any of these systems. And I'll concede to that. I think there's probably some fairer, more equitable ways to do socialism or communism than we've seen in history. The same way I think there's better and fairer ways and more justice-based ways to do a market-based system than not. And so you could have a market that's open and available. Maybe you have some public options, maybe you have government involvement in some way, but not totally. To drive prices down, and you regulate it in some capacity, and that people feel like that's capitalism, and that capitalism can't avoid government intervention at all in totality. Much of our system, whether we like it or not, is socialist. Almost everyone here is signed up for Medicare in the future in some way, or maybe people who are struggling on Medicaid. That's socialism, whether you like it or not, whether you want to inject other meanings and values into it. You know, there's very famous images of people and videos of people saying, get the government's hands off my Medicare. It's like, that's what it is. And these words were not nearly as scary in 1930 when all these government, issues were made real, when all these institutions were made law. So the point that the question is trying to get at is, we've certainly seen all sorts of corruption and unfairness in our system. Is there a way to do this that's better? Sure. It just requires a lot of effort and work by the people who want to live in a more fair society. It's hard to do. That's, mm-hmm. I don't know if people want more clarity on that, but yeah.
Okay. And so the last official question we have here is, would it not be a good thing to make an issue of getting the media to talk about issues rather than just the candidates?
Yes, absolutely. I think if we didn't get to see candidates' faces, we might get better outcomes. If we didn't get to hear their voice and associate them with some kind of, oh, I have a relative who sounds like that, or I'd like to go and get a beer with them. Maybe if we just analyze things from a purely policy position, would that be better? Maybe. But is that possible? Is that achievable in a modern social media age where we all know what each other look like and sound like and where we're going and where we're being and we're all trying to be kind of pseudo celebrities? It's hard to explicate these things. It's hard to separate these things. So certainly, I think that would be a much nicer world to live in. If we're, you know, I don't know if I mentioned it in the presentation, but many of you here have lived through the television age becoming a thing, the primary system becoming invented, and the all sorts of latent consequences that has had, that we get very different candidates post the 60s than we used to get. And there's this emphasis on attraction and how you come across and how tall are you and how charismatic are you? Do you sweat on TV? That these all became political issues when they were previously not at all. And you relied on third hand, what did a newspaper say about how that event went?
Yeah, so in my opinion, that last question is like a little bit convoluted because it says, you know, how would you force them to talk about issues? Because they do talk about what they think are the issues or they want you to think about. So I have a CNN app on my phone as well as a Fox News app, right? So the CNN app pops up with all the headline stories. You know, the January 6th committee has proved that Trump was not overthrow the government. And what are the stories coming up on Fox News? Something about the border. So they care about issues, but not the same ones.
This points to another issue, which is that we have so much media and there's so many voices now that it's hard to know what to believe, what's real, what's relevant, what matters the most. And that there's an overwhelming media role that people feel lost and confused by. And so you don't know what to focus on. Everyone finds a little pet thing. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? And so it's hard to build consensus because the incentives are the other way around. The incentives, ironically, the market incentives are towards extremism, are towards volatility, are towards emotional things that'll make us click on their websites and watch that ad. And that they're relying on things that drive human psychology for their own end, which is their legitimate end to do, but that creates problems for the body politic as we conceptualize it.
I mean, like, to be fair, like, it's a lot easier to get emotional about like a hot button issue than to try to understand how the Geneva Convention works. Like, you know, it that because just
right. What are you going to click on? What
articles brains work?
Get your attention.
Yeah. Okay, Jason. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Rob.
I was just saying, and as I've like heard from a lot of places, one of the best ways for people to be controlled is through fear, not only religious fear of hell or whatever, but in politics. If the party can convince you, you know, the outsiders are trying to get you, the society you like is going to horribly change, then they keep pushing those issues as the important issues of the day. And that's what keeps you in the party or in a religion.
Certainly. Negativity is a strong impulse. And I think, you know, we talk about a lot that these negative feelings of coming back of who's going to protect you, who's out to get you, who's in the in-group, who's not. This is the antithesis of coalition building and building solidarity and finding commonality and realizing a lot of us actually share most of our beliefs and have pretty similar understandings of what justice looks like. And that there's so much in our way to try and the preventing us from coming together and making a world that we'd all like a little more. It's a hard, as I said, hard job, hard process. It's hard to digest it on a national level or an international level for sure. It's much easier to approach this stuff on a local level where you're meeting with your neighbors, you're meeting with the people who matter most to you, you're talking with your coworkers, you're trying to figure out how to get a more fair system from the ground up where you are instead of trying to overthrow the whole thing.
And I think, like, you know, for most Americans, you know, a lot of the major issues, we have more in agreement
certainly
than opposites. But because the media focus on the two extremes, the nuance and the things that actually matter kind of get lost, you know.
Deciding what counts as extreme.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anyway, well, thank you, Jason. Like I said, this has been really informative. There was a lot here, and you know, I'm definitely, people are saying in the chat that they're going to have to go back and listen to this for review. Because
I apologize if I went too quickly on something.
No, it's fine. It's just a lot. It's a lot, because if you went through everything we talked about in detail, we'd be here till like, you know, midnight. So, yeah. You know, everybody's time is valuable.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.